Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhuff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, you've been listening to a little bit of Leonard Bernstein because it's all about celebrating his 100th birthday.
Right, 100th anniversary of his birth.
Yes.
Exactly right.
Are you settled?
Are you okay now? I'm excited.
Do you have any other noise you want to make?
There has not been a figure in American culture like Leonard Bernstein.
Unless it was Sadie Abuhoff.
Well, we have to mention Sadie.
We're also celebrating Sadie's birthday.
Right.
August 28th.
But it's not 100.
Birthday.
It's not 100.
No, she's not 100 yet.
She's not 100.
But I'll be shocked if she doesn't make it to 100.
Well, I'd be shocked too. But in any event, we're going to have to wait for that.
Let me throw in somebody else.
Yeah.
Tom Walsh.
Tom Walsh's birthday.
Who sometimes appears also on this podcast.
And he's closer to 100 than you might think. But that's true. But so Leonard Bernstein was born.
A lot of fantastic people born at this time of year.
100 years ago, Leonard Bernstein. So some people very familiar with Bernstein, some less so. And what we found ourselves discussing last night, even before we saw the articles in the Times today, which are really very good, actually, very complete, and really dominates the arts and leisure section, is we're discussing, is there anybody like him? Is there anybody like him on the scene today? Was there anyone like him on the scene before? And I think the answer, our answer in the Times is no. The way the Times discusses it is this. They say Bernstein, composer, conductor, arranger, pianist, television personality, star. There will never be another Bernstein. And if the high culture for which he tirelessly evangelized keeps drifting farther from the mainstream, his legacy is still clear and secure. When he died, he left us a charge to listen to music of all kinds with endless enthusiasm, to devote ourselves to both the creation of new work and the revival of old, to make every facet of culture accessible to all. I mean, he was a figure when we were growing up.
Well, every facet of culture.
Right.
Okay. And the reason that I know anything about classical music at all is probably largely due to him. He was a rock star.
Right.
I mean, he was on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was on, you would see him doing his tutorials.
The Young People's Concert.
The Young People's
Concert. And they ran for years.
Yeah, right.
And he was a great educator, and he could, at base, he was a fantastic composer, both in terms of Broadway music and classical music, and he was a performer in the sense of conducting. He was a great pianist also, but you saw him primarily as a conductor. And it's just kind of, it's overwhelming. I mean, he wrote some great Broadway musicals, he wrote On the Town, he wrote Wonderful Town, and he wrote, of course, West Side Story. And I'll just say, I have the opportunity to talk to some people who are professionals in the Broadway business and the show business. And whenever you get into any kind of discussion, and people don't do this a lot, but about West Side Story or, what's the best musical ever, no one discusses it. They say, oh yeah, West Side Story, well, that's the best musical ever. I mean, there's no discussion. There's no discussion. It's head and shoulders above everything else. And it's because of the music.
Whenever we turn that on.
Yeah.
Okay, it just seems as new and as fresh. Right. You don't get tired of it.
Right.
And I think that's because it's so magnificent.
Right. I mean, there's a piece by Jesse Green in the Times, and Jesse, we've mentioned him before, does a lot of Broadway reviews, and he talks about, Bernstein being a great melody writer. But as he writes, at the first note of West Side Story, can't even wait for the downbeat. It lands one hiccup early. That's how impatient the show is to get going, and Bernstein is to get going. The vocal lines of West Side Story are gorgeous, even when they're spiky, but no one writing a musical has ever used rhythm as effectively as Bernstein did to let us hear the human heart just as it's leaping forward, just as it's about to burst. That's fair. I mean, West Side Story is amazing, amazing. And of course, quite beyond that, what the Times has, and which I would be less aware of because I don't know classical music,
right,
is a lot of writing about him as a performer, as a conductor. And they speak to all these folks who were in the orchestra when he conducted.
And he certainly was prolific, and he was a prodigy. He,
Well, do you remember when we saw him conducting?
Yes, I do.
All right.
In Milan.
At La Scala.
We accidentally lucked into a rehearsal. An open rehearsal. We were rambling around Milan. We stopped in La Scala hoping to buy tickets for something. And they said, no. Go right in. It's free right now. Yeah. And he conducted Aaron Copland?
Yeah, but it was rehearsal.
It was rehearsal.
And he kept stopping and talking to the musicians in Italian in a very excited way. And they make the point here in the Times, and this is someone who's a concertmaster, is writing about performing with Bernstein. He said he would stop, well, this is a bassist for the New York Philharmonic, a man named Aaron O'Brien. He said he would stop the orchestra like every few minutes to explain the music, and sometimes 80 times in an hour he timed it. And he was, but he said they didn't mind it. There's another person who's quoted here, who's a violinist, a woman, Jenny Shames from Boston Symphony, said, for all of us that worked with him, when I ask any of them who's the greatest conductor you ever played with without skipping a beat, we all say Leonard Bernstein. That doesn't always mean he's the one we loved or was the easiest to spend time with. But it was something so commanding, so all-encompassing. They speak to a person named Menachem Breuer of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. And Bernstein had a reputation of being a great performer, playing to the galleries, a little bit of a showman, maybe too much of a showman for classical music. And what Breuer says, it was never for show. Although he was dancing on the podium, it was all emotional and sincere. Music was pouring out of his body. And there's a great photograph here, I think you've seen of the Boston Symphony, in which he looks as if he's about to fall backward into the pit.
Or leap into the air or
rise
something.
Into the air.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, he was just an amazing figure. And of course, we also got to see the other day this this piece on the building of Lincoln Center. And, we were going to bring a cultural center to New York, to the United States, and they talked about the historical significance of that, meaning that, this was post-Europe. The U.S. wanted to be taken seriously culturally as well as economically. And it wasn't taken seriously culturally. Maybe it's still not. But in terms of galvanizing that effort, there was only one figure that people focused on. And that was the figure who was conducting the New York Philharmonic as they started digging the foundation for Lincoln Center. And that was Leonard Bernstein. I mean, there's no one else like him. There's no one on the scene today. And maybe the scene's changed too much. You couldn't have that. But it's just overwhelming.
So, it's hard to imagine anybody involved in classical music today having that kind of public appeal and influence, leading into the death of the classical.
Well, maybe the classical music has just moved farther away. I can't say the death, because there are people who still go to these concerts, who support the opera, who feel strongly about it. But on the other hand, is it farther and farther on the periphery of what I'll call the cultural scene in the U.S. in particular? And you had an article about opera.
On that note, there's a review in the Wall Street Journal titled The Life in a Dead Art Form.
Right.
And it's about a book entitled Opera as Opera by Conrad L. Osborne. Now, the review is written by a music critic and historian, Joseph Horowitz, who's also quoted in that Bernstein article. So he's been a busy guy.
Right.
And he tells you about Conrad L. Osborne, who was the opera expert during the 60s, 70s, 80s for a magazine called High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, in that arena, the guy. And then High Fidelity kind of disappears in the 80s, and so does Osborne. And now he has reemerged with this book. And it turns out that this incredible opera expert was like in his 30s when he was writing.
But now it's...
Now he's 80. 80 in his 80s. He's written this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's self-published. And this is how Horowitz describes it. It is, without question, the most important book ever written in English about opera in performance. It is also a cri du cœur documenting the devastation of a single precinct of Western high culture in modern and postmodern times.
Right.
So it's a long book. It's nearly 800 pages.
And again, the title is?
Opera as Opera, right, by Conrad L. Osborne.
For those of you who want to see the definitive
long,
book.
It's, you know, it's inside baseball.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Horowitz is saying, you know, this will be interesting to anybody.
Oh, no.
But I think you really have to know something about opera.
This article is the most, what's the word? High-toned, difficult, ambitious. In the way it's written, it's written in a completely different style. It looks like it doesn't belong in the Wall Street Journal.
And, for instance, one of his sentences here, Mr. Osborne delves into the history of rhetoric and orality.
Yeah, orality. Orality is a big theme here.
Okay, and he talks about, sort of recreating in his mind performances that happened in the 30s.
Right.
So it sounds like an amazing...
It's a book for everybody.
It also serves to show me how very, very little... I know,
but it also shows you how it is on
opera,
is on the periphery. And look, it's a book for people who know about orality already. I wouldn't start with that book, but it might be interesting. It certainly got a positive review in the journal. Tennis. Let's go to tennis. Okay.
Yeah, my mom was all excited about the U.S. Open.
That's reason enough. Yeah. If your mom's plugged into it, no one is more onto the sporting scene, especially international sports, than your mother. So let's go to her favorite. So it's tennis. And so the U.S. Open begins a week from this weekend. And guess who's going? That's right. The aforementioned Sadie and her dad are going on Saturday, September 1 to see what the Open looks like today. And what I mean by that is this. The Open was not always this way. And let me just line up a couple of economic facts, which I think get confused. But I think it's important to keep in the context of the Open. When here is about Forest Hills, Flushing Meadow, amateurs, professionals, money, no money, here's the way it worked. It's not that complicated. Forest Hills is where the Open used to be. And Forest Hills was a tennis center. It was a country club. And young Dan Abbeyhoff went there several years in a row with Bob, his brother. And you would go there. It wouldn't cost a fortune. And you would see a whole lot of tennis matches just wandering around, often looking through wire fences. And you might bump into Billie Jean King by accident. Hope you didn't spill her drink or something like that.
Can we just remind the audience that your dad owned
a tennis court.
Tennis courts,
right.
Bubble tennis courts.
Right.
So tennis was part of your
that could be.
Family life.
That's right. That right. could be. Right. So we knew some folks. But in any event, that's what... Forest Hills was like. And the surface was grass and then it was clay, which is important because surface makes a difference. But here's what's actually more significant than the switch from Forest Hills to Flushing Meadows. And here's the way it lines up. It was while it was at Forest Hills, there was a cataclysmic change in tennis. And it was from amateur tennis to professional tennis. And here's the way it happened. During the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the biggest tournaments were just for amateurs. Okay.
Yeah.
Wimbledon was just for amateurs.
Right.
The U.S. Title at Forest Hills was just for amateurs. And it would attract a lot of players and a lot of people would come to see the events. Right. There were people who were so-called professional players, but they had very limited circuits. They made some money, but not a lot of money. That was like Pancho Gonzalez, Pancho Segura, Jack Kramer, folks like that. Bobby Riggs. A professional player. But they were not in the mainstream of tennis coverage because it was considered a an amateur sport. That changed in the year 1967.
Okay.
At Forest Hills. Forest Hills was renamed as the U.S. Open. What open means is it's open to amateurs and professionals. That's what the word open means.
Okay.
Because it's lost meaning over time. So what happened? What happened was in 1967... what we had is a final between Arthur Ashe, who was an amateur, and Tom Ocker, who was a professional. And Arthur Ashe won. And he said, I won't take the $14,000 prize money. That's all it was. Because I'm still an amateur. But he got a load of endorsements.
Uh-huh.
But that's the way it went. On the women's side, Virginia Wade played Billie Jean King. Virginia Wade won. She was an amateur. She said, I will take the, wasn't 14,000. Let's call it 8,000. I don't really know. It was less than 14. And she declared that day that she was a professional, right?
Interesting.
And what happened was, now that it was acceptable, now that you were opening those big tournaments, the ones people want to play to professionals, everyone turned professional. And now it was a different game. There was a lot more money. And then years later in 1978, they had to move the tournament. They didn't have to. They did move the tournament from Forest Hill to Flushing Meadows because now it's big money tennis. And Flushing Meadows has blossomed over time. And now it had for some time the Arthur Ashe Stadium, which is an enclosed roof stadium. And now is a second enclosed roof stadium. The Louis Armstrong Stadium now has a roof. And that is going to be christened this Friday and Saturday. So there you go.
You may need that.
Rumor
has it there are, you know, doubts about the weather.
All right. Well,
this
weekend. I have two stadiums I can go to in which they're covered, right. And that's a big difference. So in any event, that's a short history lesson with respect to tennis. There's a movie that's coming out.
Were talking to Michael, your brother, who played tennis in college, et cetera. And you were gabbing about, I don't know what the subject matter was exactly, but he suddenly spouted out something about John McEnroe being such a great player.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but gabbing is a funny word to apply to the two of us. But
I think of you as great gabbers.
Gabbers. Okay, so we were gabbing away. Well, we talk about McEnroe once in a while in the old times. Michael was in the same youth development program that John McEnroe was in, which Harry Hopman ran. Harry Hopman was the former Davis Cup coach for Australia. You may remember years ago, like swimming, tennis was dominated by Australians. So people offered Harry Hopman enough money to come over and start the same kind of development in the U.S. That was on Long Island.
And all right. Got it.
You had John McEnroe, and you had Michael Abuloff.
You relayed to me that Michael said, you don't understand. John McEnroe was above and beyond.
Yeah.
Still is above and beyond. Still as a senior participating.
Oh yeah, he did tell me. I had forgotten
that. He is
that.
Beating much right. younger.
He said to me. He mentioned to me. He said, "You know, he's still playing." I said, "Yeah, he's playing the senior circuit." He said, "Yeah, he just beat Mark Philippoussis." I said, "Yeah, Mark Philippoussis is no big deal. He's a good pro, but he was something. But he's a senior." He said, "You don't get it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mark Philippoussis is in his early 40s." I said, "Yeah." He said, "McEnroe's 59. Okay. McEnroe's beating everybody, and he's beating the guys 20 years younger than he is. McEnroe is a phenom and still is a phenom. So there
and
is.
On that note,
there is a movie.
French film.
Called John McEnroe, believe it or not, In the Realm of Perfection.
Okay, so Michael is on to this.
There are very few things that Michael and I gab about that we can brag on that Michael's on to, and this is one of them. But let me just read two lines from the review in the Times, which is an over-the-top review. They say the movie is a dream of Mr. McEnroe, an amusing, hypnotic, whimsical, expertly constructed adventure in craft. And as if that were not enough, and this is worth turning the page, so I'm going to turn the page. The reviewer says this. This is Wesley Morris. He says, the movie is an impressionistic conflation of humor, wonder, horror, and sympathy, a rumination about character, persona, drive, and mental collapse. We're going to see that movie.
It details the story of the final of the 1984 French Open.
Right, Roland Garros.
Where
right.
He plays against Ivan Lendl.
Yvonne Lendl. Yes.
Okay. So there you have it. It's going wide August 31st.
Wide distribution.
But yeah. But I don't think that's all that wide. So you may have to work hard.
Well, it's at Film Forum now. And, you know, I'll just mention, because one of the places, our go-to place for movies that we'll call esoteric, Lincoln Plaza. Which we had discussed here is closing and closed.
Lincoln Plaza Cinema closed.
But it's moving.
But some fans revived it,
right.
Have opened up their own version. They've apparently been showing movies at a JCC near Lincoln Center.
Right. And now
they're going to go up to your old haunt, Symphony Space.
95th Street and Broadway. So take a look for that, for the movie about McEnroe and for Lincoln Plaza Cinema in their new home. Yes, so we had an article which got me going, but my view doesn't count. Your view counts about working mothers.
Yeah, well, I can't even talk about it because I lost the first page. But It's basically is the story of working mothers, a survey or a study that is finding that fewer and fewer women feel they can work after they have children.
Right.
Okay. And they have changed their beliefs about a number of aspects of taking care of children as a working mother. Oh, here's the quote. All right. New analysis shows that something has been happening during the 1990s. Motherhood became more demanding. Parents now spend more on more time and money on childcare. They feel more pressure to breastfeed, to do enriching activities with their children, and to provide close supervision. Okay, the feeling is that, and this is prevalent amongst women with college educations. Okay, women who had mothers who were working mothers and who assumed they would have careers themselves. They feel they got it wrong. It has become harder and harder to have children. All right. They were not prepared. It's a big turnaround. But interestingly enough, as women do more paid work, men have not increased their childcare and housekeeping tasks to the same extent. Another surprise for young women who, research has shown, expected more egalitarian partnerships. Okay. Result is that women's expectations seem to be outpacing the realities of public policy, workplace culture, and family life.
Right.
Okay. So what do you want to say about that?
This is baloney from Baloneyville, is what I think. But your view counts more than mine. First, look, the idea about men shouldering a greater load, I'm not going to get into that. Maybe that's right. Maybe that ought to be. But the reality is it's just not where we are at this point in time for whatever reason. And maybe it shouldn't change. I'm just not getting into that at all. But that's not because that's not the focus of the article. The focus of the article to me is they interview women who are highly educated, who have high-powered careers before they have children. They say, what's your plan? And they plan, when I have children, I'm coming right back to work. I can do it. And then they have children, and it's time to go back to work. They say, you know, not so fast. Motherhood is a little more demanding than I thought. And then the question becomes, well, why is it? What's the disconnect? How, why are people changing their mind? And the solution they came up with is motherhood used to be not that hard, but now it's hard. It changed over the last 20 years. It's harder now. That's what this article is saying. When the obvious solution is that you underestimate, as I would underestimate, as any human being would underestimate, what's involved in raising a child. So when you ask someone who doesn't have a child.
Well, I do think that's very, very true.
Yeah.
You make all kinds of plans.
Right.
And then parenthood turns out to be much more all-consuming
right.
than you ever dreamed.
Right.
I mean, you think about all the things you will do, even though you have kids, and maybe a lot of people manage to do them. But frankly, I found it hard at the beginning just to figure out when I could take a shower
right.
or go to the bathroom,
right.
you know, much less do everything else. But I do think that parenthood has become much more of a participation sport.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There are many more things that parents are expected to do with their kids and supervise. You think about all the, sort of tiger mother activities, making sure your kid is involved in this, mm-hmm. making sure you're involved in that along with them, etc. And really, it's a full-time job trying to develop this product, which is the perfect child. I think attitudes about that have changed. Women have gotten, it feels like women have gotten more competitive about being a great mom.
All right. Listen, your view counts more than mine. I think that's an insight to me. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that, but, okay.
Yeah.
That's the way you see it. Let me get back.
But, we didn't have that problem because our children were raised by wolves.
Raised by wolves. And, they're proving it every day to, their immediate friends and family. Let me go back to, but you had something else before I get into, I was going to get into something I know more about. which is almost anything. But
well, speaking of homemaking,
yeah, okay, you had one more point
in the review section. Although a great article titled "Never Cook at Home."
Yeah.
By Deb Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Deb Perlman is another one of my girl crushes. She has a great website called Smitten Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a lot of great recipes for her. She's a fun writer. She's an interesting writer. She has great commentary and suggestions about cooking and a fabulous palate. She's interested in, you know, all kinds of food, but actually in a pretty pragmatic way. You know, cooking in a small apartment in New York fairly, you know, efficiently,
right,
et cetera, but deliciously. And she actually says, she writes this article, "There are good reasons never to cook at home." She says, "I know because I bail regularly." First of all, she says that the ingredients are expensive.
Yeah.
Okay. In a city where rents never have been higher, groceries cost huge chunks of money. As long as you can buy five dumplings in Chinatown for $1.25, it's never going to be purely economical to cook at home. What kind of monster wants to turn on an oven in August anyway? Do you know what doesn't overheat an apartment in August? A popsicle for dinner.
These are
also
all good ideas, though.
It's also hard to cook if the work day never ends.
Oh,
and that's, you know, that's immensely true now with our connections with the internet, et cetera. You don't really have time to cook. Restaurant delivery is a glorious thing. We don't have access to that so much out here in the country. And cooking, especially a new dish, is a huge gamble. And she talks about how risky recipes can be, and mentions that obstacles to cooking can come from within the house as well. Spouses, partners, roommates, you know, suddenly have a new diet and they can't eat any of what you've prepared, or they don't like what you've prepared. So it's all very complicated. So she comes up with a lot of great reasons not to cook. And she also says, maybe you have one of those types of kids who willingly eats kale. Enjoy your good luck, but keep this to yourself. You've beaten the odds. And it's impolite to brag. She says, here's why I cook. And she basically says that, it's the zen of it.
Yeah.
You get involved in cooking and it really kind of, carries you away from all the, minutiae.
Right. It's
your daily
it's a project
life.
And you get to complete the project.
This thing, focus, concentration, a goal, and the reward of something delicious,
yes,
I get to devour, is so rare in my day-to-day life, I'll take it where I can.
All right.
And so I thought that was an amusing article. Smitten Kitchen, if you don't know it, is fun. Just, you know, it's just, it's food porn.
That's this one's
really.
Blog, Smitten Kitchen.
Right? Yeah, and great recipes, great reading. I only make a fraction of what I read about, but she's a good resource, Deb Perlman.
All right. So here, back on solid ground for me, sports radio. And a subject you're interested in, of course, at the same time.
Subjected to.
Just quickly, by total coincidence, an interview with Mike Francesa. First time, long time. Of WFAN, their leading guy in sports radio. And then an article about sports radio and its prospects as a business going forward. And they both articles seem to line up, no surprise, on one important point, and that is that the sports radio is a viable business going forward. And the reason is, as Francesa puts it, what radio does more than any other medium is it allows you to really get close to your audience. Now, the way they put it in the Times media column is this. It's the relationship that a fan has to a sports radio host. On, for example, a Monday morning after a big game, the host might be as upset or as emotional as they are, and therefore they build a relationship and feel that the individual is one of them. someone they could have had on the couch on Sunday and been sharing a plate of nachos with. There's a natural opportunity for us to leverage that trust. And the result is you have a strong connection between a sports radio guy, even though he seems somewhat inarticulate and ill-informed about anything but last night's game, and the listener, so much so that there's an allegiance that follows in terms of buying products that are advertised there. And they say it goes beyond sports products. It's not just a matter of the sports radio jock saying you really should go out and support the Islanders. They mention a few other products, pillows, pens, whatever. If the sports radio guy says to them, believe me, I know your problem. You know, you have trouble getting to sleep. This will change your life. The listener goes out and buys that pillow.
Okay, the listener.
Yeah.
But if what happens when there's no radio?
What do you mean?
Isn't radio dying?
Well, not. It won't be. It won't die because of this.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Look, I will tell you this. I don't know what's going
to
die.
Does anybody younger than us listen to the radio?
Here's another thing I didn't read from that. The demographics that they have for sports radio now are not older people. Sports radio is spread all through the age groups, including a strong 18 to 30, 34 contingent, and all through various types of people. You know, not necessarily just white males, Latin listeners, Hispanic listeners,
African-American listeners. Okay, we know. All right.
That. So they have
a
broad
audience. That's very interesting.
So that's enough to support the media.
Okay, well, fun. I also read in that article that Francesa would not be averse to having a partner again. Okay.
And there's an obvious.
If they were, you know, of a certain level of quality.
Well, there you go.
Okay, so.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Anything to get you out of the house once you retire, hopefully that would get you out of the house. I don't know if that would be remote or not.
No, it might. It might. Yeah. I think I'm a logical guy. I think a lot of people feel that way. And I think it's a matter of time before there's a person.
How are you going to manage a baseball team and do that?
I'll have to figure, I'm going to have to stop cooking. So you had something, but it fit right in terms of an enthusiastic approach to dementia, I thought. It has to do with exercise, because it has to do with that. That's the connection.
Okay, so, you know, we're always on this kick about dementia. Exercise, how does exercise affect the brain, etc. Interesting article in the New York Times by Christopher Schuetz, Schuetz. Take a look at these unusual strategies for fighting dementia in the Netherlands. And we talked, I think, last week or the week before about the importance of movement and how it delivers blood to the brain and helps in various ways. In the Netherlands, they have found that being able to deal with people with dementia, soothe them. Sometimes some aspects of dementia are not simply not being able to express oneself or understand what's going on, but to lose control of emotions and have outbursts and fits, etc. And this is very often dealt with medications or restraints. As a alternative to this, in the Netherlands, they've been developing various strategies to soothe such patients, including trying to create sort of environments that would be soothing, like a beach room with lawn chairs and snacks and sand, etc. Or also a fake bus where people sit in chairs and see the world go by. And one person actually sits up front and drives. Or for the very severe ones that can't even leave their bed, perhaps, projecting soothing images on the ceiling, perhaps of landscapes, animals, etc. But even they're creating bicycle journeys. And this is interesting to us in the Netherlands because so many of those people grow up biking, and they can use these bicycles that recreate an actual virtual trip. And they're even available to patients who have pretty limited mobility. Also, environments meant to recreate what a kitchen looked like in the 40s, in the 30s, that might resonate deep within them in their memories. And they're finding that these strategies are able to reduce the amount of medications used and make these people, give these people much better quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a fun alternative.
All right. And I guess we're still in the sports area, just very quickly, because we're going on. Japanese baseball. We talked about Japanese baseball before. Yet another article about Japanese baseball. And yet I can't. We're getting addicted to Japanese baseball. We're going to have to go to Japan. And the journal, happily, tells us that we can see Japanese baseball in Japan. It's easy to do because there are four different stadiums that are within an hour of Tokyo. And they describe the four different stadiums. They explain what it's like. And here's what it's like. The fight songs begin before the first pitch of the game. And they never let up. Each time a player approaches the plate, thousands of fans packed into the stands, cheer, burst into a different song, all while watching every pitch, every swing of the bat, and every routine ground ball with rapt attention.
So even though we don't know the players, et cetera, we would get caught up in the enthusiasm?
We would get caught up, and I will say just...
How many people really follow Japanese baseball from the U.S.?
That I can't say. There's a fellow, they do quote a fellow named Robert Fitz, who I happen to know, and they describe how Robert Fitz became involved with Japanese baseball because he was married to a lawyer who went to Japan for her law firm. And that lawyer, I don't mind saying, was Sarah Fitz, who was a partner of mine. Rob went out there to Japan, fell in love with Japanese baseball, has written several books about it. Happily, they came back to the U.S. I played softball with Robert Fitz. He is an excellent softball player, so I assume he knows quite a bit about Japanese baseball. And he says it's the greatest. And people just love it. The snacks are great. The tickets are cheap. They tell you where to sit. You're supposed to sit in certain sections. If you want to be a part of that cheering group and you cheer for that team, they'll sell you that ticket. But don't do it if you don't know enough. They have a special part. They like Americans well enough. They'll seat you somewhere. But there are certain sections that are for the diehard fans of each team who are going to sing and chant and cheer the entire game. It's supposed to be really something.
So you don't want to be in the dog pound if you're not...
If you're not a partisan and knowledgeable. But it sounds like it's worth going to.
Yeah. Japanese baseball. So moving right along here, another article from the review section of the New York Times. This one by Adam Grant, an organizational psychologist from UPenn. And his article is titled, Those Who Can Do Can't Teach.
Yes.
And his primary example is Einstein, who, pretty smart guy, knew a lot of stuff, and was a terrible teacher. And he actually had a course at one point. He got three of his friends to sign up for it. And the next term, it was actually canceled. They couldn't get anybody to sign up for it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a big surprise that someone deep into a particular subject or...
Well, listen, I had a course at Princeton with someone who worked with Einstein named Valentine Borgman, who was a theoretical physicist, and he couldn't teach. So I know exactly what you're talking about. But part of it was the language barrier. I mean, Einstein was probably trying to teach
him. Part of it is that they know too much about their subject.
Now, you see, I know that's what the article says, but I don't think that's exactly right. I think they know a lot about their subject, but that what they don't fully appreciate or fully invest in is that they have in their minds embedded the logical progression of thought that led them to the discoveries, conclusions, understandings, and beliefs they now have. And that's the way they tend to talk about it. But if you're going to teach something, you have to put all that aside.
And that's hard to do.
And you have to say, but how am I going to explain it to somebody else? And that's what these people don't do.
Well, we've talked about this phenomenon before because with reference to instructions.
Right.
For operating something or building something. They're written by engineers who already know how to do this, and they can't put themselves in the place of
slate. They put themselves, they're entrapped in the stream of consciousness that led them to their understanding. And you have to step out and do it a different way. And these folks, people don't do it. On the other hand, we just talked about Lenny Bernstein being a great teacher. And it's not because he didn't understand the subject, because he stepped outside and thought about what you really ought to know,
how you might know.
Anyway, it. Mr. Grant is giving some advice how to find a good teacher.
Right.
And so, I've run into this a million places. Right. You know, I go to the Met for a lecture. Right. You have a brilliant curator.
Oh, I've been to those lectures
with you. And they can't
talk
at all.
Those have put a strain on our marriage.
It's different skills. Right. It's different skills. He suggests, first of all, look for somebody who, you know, learned the subject recently, fairly recently, because they may remember about not knowing it.
Right.
Okay. Number two, go for somebody who's not a prodigy. Go for somebody who had to work hard to learn the subject, whether it's, you know, a sport or an academic subject. That really, nothing teaches you better how to teach than having to learn it yourself and work hard to learn it. What else does he say?
I think they're all along the same lines. He's just saying, look out for people who aren't really enmeshed as experts, but understand and recall, you know, what it was like learning it themselves, and they're going to help you do it.
Well, he also says go for people who are not on the tenure track.
Yeah, okay.
Well, maybe they're more invested in
like an adjunct.
The teaching.
Like Tamsin Granger. Ask who's a good teacher. I mean, yeah, there's no question. There's clearly a difference between the world's greatest expert and the world's greatest teacher. Those are two entirely different.
But he also says that those who can teach...
Yeah, I heard that. I don't know.
Can do.
Right, maybe. But that's based on anecdotal evidence. We saw a movie. We got to get to the movies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We saw The Spy Who Dumped Me. You've been bothering me about not taking you to see The Spy Who Dumped Me.
It was fun. It's a girl buddy picture.
Starring
Mila Kunis.
And
Kate McKinnon.
And
neither of them I know very well, but they were quite good together. I've read a lot of, they got bad reviews and some good reviews.
No, I saw some good reviews.
Yeah, but there are a fair amount of bad reviews.
Oh, really?
And they say that the women have no chemistry. I thought they had a great chemistry.
I thought they had a great chemistry, too.
And there's violence, there's blood, there's bad language, but it's really pretty funny. And we had a good time.
Yeah, I will say the only insight I bring to this is that, first of all, I did enjoy it. And I wasn't sure I was going to, number one. Number two is... Yeah, it's totally improbable. It's a goofy thing, and it's over the top. Having said that, they retain the integrity of the characters. As you were saying, the chemistry, the characters. They're the same characters throughout. You see a lot of movies where they just don't care anymore. It's one goofy setup. And who are these people on the screen? They're just saying something outrageous. These are real people. They're unusual, but they're real people. And that brings the movie home.
Okay, so The Spy Who Dumped Me.
Yes. If you can't get in the theater, get it on an airplane.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be in the theater much longer. Right, and so speaking of acting, there's a review of a book by Peter Rader, Playing to the Gods, and it's the story of dueling divas from the late 19th, early 20th century, Sarah Bernhardt and Eleonora Duse. And you know Sarah Bernhardt is really over the top, out there, the kind of person who has a pet alligator who drinks champagne, and her acting style was similar, okay? On the other hand, Duse was famous for a very stripped-down, minimalist investment in the character, so much so that it's Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg will base their methodology on her example. And yet, have any of us really heard about this woman? Not so much.
And Stella Adler, and Strasberg is bringing up, and those are the people behind Brando and a lot of folks in that same
method style is, you know, descended from this woman's style.
Jimmy Dean, Steve McQueen, et cetera, et cetera.
Who would play a role that Bernhardt would play with, you know, in extravagant gowns and gesticulation. Duse would show up in a chemise, you know, a nightie. Very stripped down. So this sounds like a fun and interesting book, Playing to the Gods by Peter Rader. I have more? Oh, yes. there's more.
The director has just signaled us for one more story from Tamsin. Here we go.
Just quickly, this is an interesting memoir by Claire Tomlin, A Life of My Own. It's reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. You said you saw a review
in the, Times,
the New York Times.
They liked it.
And this reviewer, Daphne Merkin, says there are two kinds of memoirs, those that reveal too much, those that reveal too little, and this one navigates those extremes perfectly. She's a writer of biographies, right. A variety of biographies, Samuel Pepys, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, and others. She was married to Nick Tomlin, who was killed in the Yom Kippur War. Really? He was a journalist.
Okay.
And so she loses him early, 1973. She had met him at Cambridge, mm-hmm. and she was part of a whole Cambridge intelligentsia crowd, Oxbridge. This review refers to them at one point. And so she actually, they have four children together. They have kind of a tumultuous marriage. One of the children actually has real challenges. But nonetheless, she develops her own career as an editor and writer of biography. And, later in life, in 1973, she marries Michael Frayn.
He's a great playwright.
The playwright. And she remarks, middle-aged love proved stronger than anything I had known before and enduring. And just to mention, Michael Frayn and Claire Tomlin, turns out, were part of that whole little group that Nina Stibbe wrote about in her book, Love, Nina.
Wasn't Alan Bennett in that group, too?
Alan Bennett, yeah. Exactly. They're all living
I can't remember who wrote in that same area. Was it Frayn?
They must have
Bennett?
Been around the street from the woman who lived in the...
Right, woman on the driveway.
The woman in the van.
Woman in the Van, which was a movie with Maggie Smith.
Nina was the nanny
yeah.
For... I'm blanking on her name.
Well, that's right.
Famous woman editor. And it's a great, it's a fun book. It's a fun, readable book you can read in small bites. Love, Nina. I would go back to that. And I would also, if you're interested in a memoir, A Life of My Own by Claire Tomlin.
Okay. So finally, we close. We have the one obituary we're going to talk about. Barbara Harris died. So Barbara Harris was a very interesting person. It turns out, and this I was less aware of, is that she was one of the people who started Second City, which was a very influential improvisational comedy group that emerged out of Chicago.
I had no idea.
Right, and that was with Alan Arkin Ed Asner, who was Lou Grant and Mary Tyler Moore. And people used to say, Ed Asner. And I'd say, well, why? Is he famous? And now you know, because he was in Second City at the beginning, but it was started in part by Barbara Harris. And she was a great performer on Broadway, and I was mentioning to you before, Kristen Chenoweth is very well known on Broadway now, but what Kristen Chenoweth does in Laura's part are plays in which the original cast was Barbara Harris, and she was a similar personality. She was a singer, she was a comedian, and by those plays, I mean those would be The Apple Tree and On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever. She also had not an insubstantial movie career following that. She was a key player in Nashville. For those who remember Nashville, the sprawling Robert Altman epic, which at the time was considered a big-time movie and close to winning the Best Picture of the Year, about all these different characters descending in Nashville, all trying to make their mark in country music, some of them trying to become stars who were nobodies. She has wanders around the entire movie as someone who just got up the nerve to leave her husband. And there is a cataclysmic event near the end, and there's chaos at the concert. And she, in sort of a half-shattered state, just picks up a microphone and sings a song that I think is called It Don't Bother Me. And over the course of that 3 minutes, it galvanizes the audience in the movie. They go from shock to grief to paying attention to her, to standing ovation, and it galvanizes the folks in the movie theater. But to others, she'll be famous because she was in the original Freaky Friday as the mother to Jodie Foster. So
one of the things I found interesting about her in the obituary is that she never liked performing that much.
That's right.
She was much more interested in the process. She loved rehearsing. She loved working with those people in Second City. Much more than any actual performance.
Which might be why she's not more famous.
True.
So we'll close with...
one of my favorites.
Yes.
Of hers.
It's Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here.
From On a Clear Day.
On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever. And, it's funny. You listen more than I, but we both do, to the Broadway channel, and they play that a lot, and that's Barbara Harris. So
That's it. From Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
Thanks.
Buds below, up is where to grow, up with which below can't compare with. Hurry, it's lovely up here. Life down a hole takes an awful toll, what with not a soul there to share with. Hurry, it's lovely up here. Wake up, bestir yourself, it's time that you disinter yourself. You've got a spot to fill, a pot to fill, and what a gift package of